That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are things that we take for granted in our contemporary lives. Clean water, flushing toilets, streetlights, cars, fresh food, knowing the time. Things so basic to how we function that we don't even consider their origins. Stephen Johnson does. His perspective on history is not about wars and great men. Instead, he looks at the hobbyists, the obsessive tinkerers, the garage mechanics, and sometimes college dropouts. People whose ideas set off a series of events, inventions, and outcomes that brought us to how we live today. Stephen Johnson is author of several best-selling books on innovation. Most recently, How We Got to Now, 6 innovations that made the modern world, and he's host of the PBS series of the same name. It's now available for viewing online in its entirety. And Stephen Johnson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
That's nice to be here.
So you didn't choose the steam engine or nuclear fission or the assembly line, but time, glass, cold, sound, clean, and light. Tell me about these decisions.
I'm glad you named them all because I often blank on one or two of them when I'm actually asked to name them myself, so that's good.
It's like the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I forgot Sleepy. One of the things that I wanted to do, or we wanted to do with the show, is to not focus on innovations that seem very high tech, right? We talk about innovation all the time in our society, but it's always about the latest gadget and, you know, the latest smartphone app and things like that. And so what I was interested in is things that have become so integrated into our lives that we no longer think of them as innovations in themselves, like glass, for instance.
Well, let's start with one of those most profound notions and the most far-reaching, time, which our concept of which has changed dramatically over the past 150 years when agrarian concepts of time were replaced by clocks, or more importantly, the pocket watch. These are the efforts of a man who was called the Lunatic of Boston in his time. Who was he? What was his story?
A surprising number of people in the book were called the Lunatic of Boston.
Yeah, Boston like figures
Boston
primarily.
Have this, it simultaneously generates interesting thinkers, but they are ridiculed by their peers. So it's this guy, Denison, who came up with this idea for basically kind of mass producing a watch. So up until around 1850, 1860, pocket watches were in circulation, but they were extremely expensive. And this guy, Denison, came up with this system basically modeled after the, kind of industrial production lines that were starting to appear for manufacturing things like guns. And he built this watch. It was called the Ellery watch. And it was really the first kind of breakthrough watch. It cost about a tenth of what other pocket watches cost at the time. And, it was kind of the kind of first draft of what then would become the, you know, the kind of Sony Walkman and the iPod more than 100 years later.
And it was also called the Soldier's Watch because so many soldiers had them during the Civil War. One of the results is that punctuality over a couple of decades becomes a social virtue, which was problematic at a time when hundreds of towns across the country had their own time, as did the 50 railroads operating in the U.S. That's what we learn from your book. How was this fixed?
Yeah, I love this is one of my favorite things because this is a classic example of this. We never think of coordinating time as an innovation, right? But as you said, in the United States, until around 1880, every single town was basically on its own time zone. So you would do a local reading of the sun. The point at which the sun was the highest in the sky was noon. And that meant that, you know, as you went from town to town, it would be 2 minutes ahead or 5 minutes behind the last town. And the key thing about this is that nobody even noticed that this was a problem. It genuinely wasn't a problem for an extremely long period of time because nobody needed to coordinate schedules between towns with that level of accuracy. It didn't matter if you lost a minute or two going from town to town because it took you an hour and a half on your horse to get from one town to the other. And then a new technology came along that exposed this problem or made it a problem in the first place, which was the railroad. The railroad suddenly meant that people were traveling from town to town in very kind of meticulously choreographed time schedules. And suddenly it was just incredibly hard to figure out what time it was. And so someone needed to solve this. And they'd kind of come up with the idea of standardizing time in Canada and in the UK. But in the US, it took quite a while. It was this guy named William Allen, who was a kind of railway clerk, basically, who got obsessed with this idea of building a time zone system. It was amazingly controversial. So all these during the period, this period, there are all these kind of angry letters to the editor written by people in towns across the country that are saying, Cincinnati will never adopt this artificial devil's time. You know, time is meant to be set by the sun as God intended it. But eventually people came around and actually the original time zone system that lasted for about 30 or 40 years, the edges of each division that now basically run along the edges of the states. Originally in Allen's map, it was defined by the railroad termination points, not by the states, which shows you how important the rail system was to our sense of time in the late 19th century.
William Allen triggers this kind of chain of events, right? And this happens often in this book, in this series. One person trying to solve a problem, getting something stuck in their craw. One such man I think of, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville. He's a
nice pronunciation.
Well, you know, I did my best. A French bookseller, essential in recording sound. Now, tell us more about him and his innovation.
So he invented a brilliant machine. It was called the phonautograph for recording audio, for capturing sound waves out of the air in the early 1850s, which is more than 20 years before Edison invents the phonograph. But the reason we've never heard of him is that he failed to include one key feature, which was playback. There was no way to listen to the audio that had been recorded. You could just record these little sound waves, but there was no way to actually hear what you'd recorded. And it wasn't like he was trying to add this feature and couldn't figure out how to do it. It never even occurred to him. He was just, as I said, it was kind of in his blind spot. Basically, his technology didn't take off, and he more or less died penniless. But two things happened. First off, a number of years later, another inventor was tinkering with Scott's device, and that inventor was Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone. So the phonautograph failed on its own, but it contained the seeds of this other technology that would take off. And the other cool thing about this story is that a group of audio historians, they got together a couple years ago and they found Scott's recordings and they scanned them into a computer and got the computer to play them back. And initially they thought they were hearing a little girl singing, but then they realized they were playing it too fast and they slowed it down and realized it was Scott himself. Half a century later, he finally got playback added to his phonautograph.
Well, and there's just a wonderful moment in the PBS series when you play that audio. Let's just hear a little bit of it. We're talking with Stephen Johnson about some of the innovations that were so big that we don't even think about them. He is the host of the new PBS series, How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World, and a book of the same name. Understanding innovation and what you do is the long zoom, as you call it, over history. You encourage us to get rid of this concept of the eureka moment and instead look at the slow hunch. Thinking of one story, Frederick Tudor, who dreamed of getting rich by shipping ice to the Caribbean. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of his slow hunch into becoming the Ice King.
Yeah, he had this idea as a young man. This is, 1800 or so, and he went – he was from Boston, from a kind of well-to-do family in Boston. He went south to the Caribbean and then to South Carolina, Georgia, and during the summer, and he was just kind of appalled at how hot it was. And he got this idea that if he could somehow take ice from these frozen lakes up in New England and store it and then ship it down to the South, to the hotter parts of the world that presumably could charge a lot of money for it. First off, he had to figure out a way to keep the ice from melting. And so he devised these various forms of kind of insulation that would do it. And it's amazing. It seems strange to us now. But if you have a large block of ice, it will survive without melting for quite a long time if you just basically pack it in sawdust and keep it out of the direct sun. So he figured that part out. But the part that really took him a long time to get was he managed to get the ice down to I think he went to Martinique initially. And when it arrived, he figured out how to keep it without it melting. But his problem was that people just had no interest in his product. And say, basically, if you were living in the Caribbean in 1800 and you'd never left the Caribbean, you would have never seen ice. It just, you know, it never got cold enough naturally for ice to form, and there was no way to mechanically make it. And so he basically had to kind of educate the customer that, you know, ice cream and taking a nice cool bath and putting an ice in your drink was a nice thing to do. And eventually he did persuade people of this, and he ultimately, you know, years and years and years later, after being mocked as another lunatic of Boston, he ended up being worth hundreds of millions of dollars in today's currency. And for a brief period of time, ice was the number one, number two export in the United States after cotton.
Okay, we're going to take a break. But when we return, more of my conversation with Stephen Johnson, author of the book and the PBS series, How We Got to Now. We'll be back with the discussion of the myth of the lone inventor and perhaps the worst job to have in the era of the whale oil lamp.
The youngest boy on ship, who could be like 12 or 13 years old, would then crawl into the skull of the whale and extract this whale oil with a bucket.
That's when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our discussion with Stephen Johnson. His most recent book, How We Got to Now, has also been turned into a companion series from PBS. It's all about the surprising innovations and chain reactions that help shape our world. Things like pocket watches or the ice cube or glass. Stephen Johnson, are these innovations really the result of the lone inventor? I mean, if Frederick Tudor had not launched the ice trade in the 19th century, if Edward Leon Scott had not invented the phonoautograph, would it have just been somebody else?
You know, it's a great question. I spent a lot of time trying to get this right. It's a tricky thing, particularly thinking about the format that I was working with, because I was developing this as a show on PBS and then as a book. And in a funny way, television kind of wants you to have a hero, you know,
yeah,
you want
right.
to have the person you can see. But a lot of the message of this project is that, you know, that invention is much more of a collective, collaborative network kind of affair, and that the single inventor is actually very unusual. In fact, there's a whole segment in both projects where we talk about Edison and how every school kid learns that Edison invented the light bulb. And in fact, Edison didn't invent the light bulb. Mm-hmm. There were 20 people who were working on the light bulb in various forms, almost all of whom hit upon most of the key ingredients that Edison hit upon. And Edison was aware of those people and building on their ideas. And as you kind of implied, there's an inevitability to that invention. Someone was going to invent the air conditioner by the, you know, kind of first years of the 20th century. It happened to be this guy, Willis Carrier, but there were other people working on it. And, you know, it was going to be invented by someone. It was just, in a sense, in the air.
With all of these positive changes, of course, you know, there is a less glowing side to some of them, especially for our Paleolithic era human bodies, you know. How have these innovations changed the way that we eat, live, sleep? What were the implications as far as you found in those areas?
Yeah, well, our bodies are not as evolving as quickly as the as the technology, mm-hmm. as our culture is, basically. And so occasionally you get this kind of lag. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that until artificial light came along in kind of the abundance of the late 19th century, where you had kind of gas lamps and then the electric light bulb in kind of the 1890s and at the turn of the century, up until that point, in particularly in the winter, people basically would have what they call two sleeps. So they would go to bed as soon as it got dark, which, you know, in the Northeast could be, you know, 5 or 5:30 or something like that. And so they go to bed at 6 because there was nothing to do, basically. There wasn't enough light to kind of make it worthwhile to stay up. You had a couple of candles and it was expensive to have those candles burning and so on. So people would go to sleep, but they weren't, you know, they didn't want to sleep for 14 hours. And so they would wake up in the middle of the night and be up for an hour or two and have a snack, you know, hang out, maybe light a candle and read a little bit, or, you know, procreate or, you know, use the facilities, whatever. Here, I'm trying to be gentle about this. And then they would go back to sleep and they would have a second sleep. And then all of a sudden artificial light came around, and suddenly after dark, your home, just your home alone or the outside world, was filled with all these things that you could do, you know. And you were like, well, I'm going to stay up and read initially, or I'm going to go out to a restaurant, or I'm going to go out and see a movie, or now I've got television and radio and I'm going to stay up and do that. And so we pushed back our bedtimes. And the argument is that when some of us suffer from insomnia, where we wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's really that kind of the echo of this natural rhythm of sleep that we'd had for presumably thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. that has been artificially interrupted by this light cycle of the electric light bulb.
And in that conversation about light, you point out that the use of whale oil light made it possible for people like Jane Austen and Herman Melville and Emily Dickinson to stay up and write at night. I mean, just one of these things we would never think of. Do you have a sort of like craziest revelation of triggered actions during this series for you?
Well, I think actually the whale oil that powered, you know, kind of artificial light in that period of spermaceti oil from the skull of the sperm whale. And it was basically the cleanest and purest and kind of whitest light you could find. It was the state of the art in kind of lighting technology from about 1730, 1740 until around 1840 or so. And this is one of these places actually where there's a really interesting kind of disjunction, it would seem, from the state of the art in other technologies. So to extract this whale oil, they would first capture a sperm whale and kill the whale, which is incredibly hard to do. But then they would have the whale up on the deck and they would cut a hole in the whale's skull. And the youngest boy on ship, who could be like 12 or 13 years old, would then crawl into the skull of the whale and extract this whale oil with a bucket. And so this is in an age when, you know, people were inventing the railroad and the telegraph and all these advanced, you know, technologies, and the steam engine, you know, is rewriting the kind of history of the world at that point. But simultaneously with all of that, the most advanced form of artificial lighting involved a 13-year-old crawling around in a whale skull.
Who'd been dead probably for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems wrong that those two things would be happening at the same time. But sometimes you get advances in one field that kind of jump ahead and the other field kind of lags behind.
There are a lot of big questions that are circulating, of course, in our culture now about whether, you know, we're so scattered or stressed out by always being accessible, being always on, using our smartphones, for example. These innovations have changed the way we work, the way we live. And with your long zoom of history, are we going to work these kind of questions out?
Well, I think, we're better at projecting forward, I think, and thinking about the unintended consequences. It's very hard to do that. I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at innovation, but every time anybody asks me to, like, you know, wear my futurist hat and describe, you know, what life is going to be like in 20 or 30 years, I always kind of politely decline, because I'm like, if you look back at this book, you know, and one of the big lessons is that, you know, you invent one thing and it ends up triggering all these changes that you would have never anticipated in advance. And that's going to keep happening. But I think we're a little bit better. I think there's a lot more, for instance, writing about technology today that is thinking about the cultural impact of these new tools and not just you know, kind of reviewing them as products. You know, I remember when I first started writing about technology, if you looked at people writing about computers, it was just, you know, it was just product reviews. You know, mm-hmm. it was like, oh, there's a new Mac and I give it 4 stars. And the idea that these machines were going to ripple out through society and change the way we listen to music and change the business models of all these creative industries and affect the way we communicate with our friends and the way that families form and national border, all these, you know, issues now that we kind of take it for granted that technology is going to shape our lives in this way. I don't think that was as much a part of the conversation 25 years ago, say. And so I think we don't have any easy answers to this, but we were at least, you know, asking the right questions now.
Well, Stephen Johnson, just fascinating. It just triggers so many questions, and I appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed it a lot.
Stephen Johnson, his most recent book is also a PBS series called How We Got to Now, 6 Innovations That Made the Modern World. There are links to find more, including video trailers from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. And Word of Mouth continues to unearth curious histories with the story of a controversial and really complicated figure at the center of Portsmouth's historical preservation movement. This was back in the mid-20th century. Miss Dorothy Vaughan. We'll get a portrait when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's all the talk in Portsmouth, architectural appropriateness. When discussing whether the new port walk is a monstrosity or whether the salt piles are a blight, or the prospect of a skating rink at Strawberry Bank, one often hears the refrain, Miss Vaughan would be turning over in her grave. A new play explores the complicated life and legacy of Miss Vaughan, Dorothy M. Vaughan, known as the little old lady in the straw hat who led the charge to save Portsmouth's historic properties against a tide of post-war redevelopment. The Strawberry Bank Museum is celebrating its upcoming 50th anniversary with a new play about Vaughan, produced in conjunction with Kent Stevens Stage Force. Saving Portsmouth, The Preservation Crusades of Miss Dorothy Vaughan takes a deeper look at the woman who came to symbolize historic preservation in the port city, justifiably or not. And Kent Stevens wrote and directs the play. Kent, great to have you with us.
Great being here, Virginia.
And Leslie Pasternak, who plays Miss Dorothy Vaughan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I should say Miss Dorothy Vaughan. It was very Miss at that time.
It was always Miss, yeah.
Indeed.
Well, until it was Doctor, and she got her honorary doctorate from New Hampshire, from University of New Hampshire, for what she had done in starting the Strawberry Bank Museum.
But still, when people have these arguments about what's going on in the state of Portsmouth, people say, oh, Miss Dorothy Vaughan would be turning over in her grave. So who was Miss Dorothy Vaughan?
Miss Dorothy Vaughan is the person generally credited with delivering the one big public message through a speech that she did to the Rotary Club in the mid-50s, and she was the first woman ever to address the Rotary Club. This was at a time when women weren't even allowed to be members. And she's generally the one credited with waking up the city of Portsmouth to the economic potential, right, the cultural economy potential of preserving its own historic buildings.
And pretty far ahead of a lot of what was going on in the U.S. at the time, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, ironically, not ahead of a lot of what was going on in Portsmouth. I mean, it had started in Portsmouth back in the 30s with John Mead Howells and Stephen Decatur. They had proposed creating a national park down on the waterfront, you know, and it had continued through other people's initiatives. But Dorothy was the person who, rightly or wrongly, and some people think wrongly, got the credit for lighting the fuse that really gave birth to all the preservation movements that have followed since then in the town and, you know, and to this day, the disputes that take place on whether you want to put a fence in front of your historic home and whether you want to build a skating rink down at Strawberry Bank Museum, you know, and we have a new dispute just about every week.
So this small woman in her pink suit and her straw hat is how she's described speaking to the Rotary Club. How did you, Leslie, approach her as a character?
Well, that's an interesting question. I come into it with a bit of a background as a historian myself, but I looked to Kent as a director, and he said, let me direct you, and it was marvelous. He really has tried to channel the spirit of Dorothy on the page, and so he reminded me, he said, we'll give you the wigs, we'll give you the suits, and let the writing guide you. And through the relationships, he's written very snappy dialogue, the relationships that she has with different people of different status and different functions in the city of Portsmouth at times, various times in her career.
Oh.
And so you find
so she gets has a different rhythm or
yes, you
voice.
Find who she is as she interacts with other people.
She was also the head town librarian.
She was head of the Portsmouth Library. She worked at the Portsmouth Library from the time she was a teenage intern until the time she retired at age 72. They gave her an extra 18 months, even though mandatory retirement age was 70. So she worked at the library for 53 years.
Wow. And how did she get involved in historic preservation?
She when her family moved to Portsmouth from Pinnacook, her dad, a semi-pro ball player, got a job working at the shipyard, and they lived in those row houses on State Street across from the John Paul Jones house. And there was a ladies' aid society rolling bandages, you know, during the war. That would have been World War I. And she was interested in that house. She wanted to see the inside of that house. So she went over and she volunteered for a day to roll bandages. And all these ladies thought it was terrific that this young pre-teenager was going to help out with the effort, right? But, you know, she rolled a few bandages and then she snuck upstairs and stuck her nose through all the rooms. And she said later it was her first taste of colonial architecture.
Mm. And the colonial revival movement was pretty strong at this point?
Or? Well, Nutting, when was Wallace Nutting? I'm unsure. I think about the 20s. It was actually probably not yet. Right, but it was coming. I mean, you know, the colonial revival was generally credited with starting with the Columbia Exposition in the late 1880s because the most popular thing there, I think I've got this right, I talk about it in another play, was a recreation of a colonial homestead and farm, right? It was the most popular attraction at the fair, and that kind of kicked off the colonial revival movement. But as we say in the play, the real colonial revival movement, to some degree, was ancestor worship, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right. All these immigrants had come in with their own customs and
right.
their own styles of
you know,
building.
So it was definitely triggered by fear of outsiders, fear of immigration, the need to assert American values, right? And there was a class level to it of, we are now going to indoctrinate the newcomers into our American values. So this is how your houses should look, right? You know, these are the things you should surround yourself with, right? You know, I mean, it's the usual sort of culturalization process that happens, you know, with outsiders.
Mm-hmm. And she was largely responsible, or let's say the face of getting Strawberry Bank Museum.
She became the face, and we talk about this in the play, because a lot of the other people who were the drivers of it, you know, people like Donald Margeson, who had the furniture store downtown, and, you know, and Jim Smith, who owned the Wentworth, a lot of them were also town councilors. So when it came to the town council needing to vote on the creation of the colonial village, a lot of those men had to drop off of the board of the colonial village in order to vote as town councilors for the project. So by default, Dorothy ended up becoming first voluntary president of Strawberry Bank, Inc., and she was their first president for about 4 years.
And she eventually built this empire. You know, she was sort of the woman behind the Portsmouth Library and behind Strawberry Bank Museum until she wasn't anymore. Well, tell us a little bit about her unraveling, Leslie.
Well, what has come through to me in the script and trying to find the emotional underpinnings that will help pull an audience through is that she did have this incredible affinity for the buildings and for the romanticized notions of the past, and indeed didn't have, it doesn't seem, a lot of real deep relationships with people. She had male mentors that she idolized. She was big on idolizing. And so in her quest to keep alive romantic notions, she stepped all over people sometimes with her opinions. And it feels as if, from what I take from Kent's script, she fell out of step with not only perhaps what was best for Portsmouth, but also what it really meant to have a museum that was documenting history, and that history and how we make it evolves, and the fashion of what it meant to have colonial recreations in Portsmouth moved on. And very well-educated people were brought in to professionalize Strawberry Bank, and that infuriated her. Mm. And so a large part of her downfall is apparently she felt she needed to remain the keeper of a lot of these objects. And so the best place to do that was in her own home, sneakily. And so this is part of what happened. So you see her, she lived for a very long time, Virginia. She was 99 when she passed. That's a very long time when you are an eccentric teenager to begin with, and all you care about is the taste of colonial architecture. She, you know, I've developed an affection for her, but someone said to me after the show the other night, they said, "Oh, your character was so marvelous." And I said, "She may have been more marvelous on stage than she was to live with day in and day out."
Pretty complicated.
Yeah.
Do you have a little bit from the play? Can you set it up for us?
Absolutely. Well, this monologue Kent has woven into the play at a wonderful point where you have seen her clash with the new professionals who are taking over Strawberry Bank. Mm-hmm. And she is being, in a sense, evicted out of her role there. And so she does what she always does, which is grab the phone to vent to a girlfriend. And so I'll begin in the latter part of this monologue with a line that could be true today. She says, "Oh, you're right. It's all fights now. It's all dog eat dog. But, you know, I have a letter. How did I meet Mr. Lessem? It must have been through Mr. Appleton. I got a letter right in the middle of that nuttiness in 63. Were we going to get the Goodwin Mansion moved or not? That awful time when I hardly slept. I got a letter from Harold Lessem. He was just finishing up at Salem Maritime National Park. He's at Antietam now. But I still have it under the glass on top of my desk where I can see it every day. He said to me, he's talking about struggles, mine, his own. He says, above all, we learn that we must be stubborn, indefatigable, and immune to discouragement. In this respect, you stand out as a symbol of all these qualities. It's not about me. We built this for Portsmouth. We can't let it get taken away by snotty strangers who don't give a tinker's damn. Oh, I am not swearing. Plumbers would build a dam, no N, of dough to contain the solder, but after it was used once, it was thrown away. These people don't give a tinker's damn about Portsmouth."
And as the playwright, who is a character in the play, says, that etymology is totally whitewashed. Tinkers were forever hitting their thumbs with hammers, so a swear word from a tinker didn't amount to much. Of course, that revisionist history was what she was all about, mm-hmm. which is what drove the PhD historians crazy, you know, because she told these very old stories, very romanticized stories about Portsmouth history, many of which have been, you know, largely discredited since. But she kept telling them. She kept protecting that romantic vision of Portsmouth's past.
So it became true on some level.
Including the fact that the library building was not designed by Charles Bulfinch, the famous Boston architect, and they didn't take the sign down until after Sherm Pridham succeeded her as head librarian.
As complicated as she was, however, was she successful in helping Portsmouth citizens to really see their historic past and the value of that in economic terms?
I think she in her better moments credited the large number of people, and we try to do that in the script as well. You know, so many people who contributed to this idea of spreading the gospel of preservation. But by the very fact that she was as long-lived as she was and that she was head librarian and therefore to some degree controlled public information, she had a bigger megaphone than most people, right? And that megaphone broadcast that message constantly. The Portsmouth Public Library had a greater collection of works on local history than just about any library of comparable size in the country.
Wow.
It had only 16 books about biology.
So this the is most the world which, according to Miss Dorothy
The most recent
Vaughan.
Of which was a 1947 high school textbook. This was in the mid-70s, right? But it had this amazing collection on local history because of Dorothy.
Mm. And what would she think of the town now? It is no longer a working class town. A little precious. let's say. Very expensive.
Very expensive. And I think she tried to disguise her roots early, but it's very interesting. You know, we have a couple of scenes with her and the famous Evelyn Marconi. You know, Evelyn Marconi, of course, of Gino's Chowder House. She became a town councilor. She became assistant mayor. Her chowder house is to this day a great Republican stronghold. She was one of the strongest voices against forming Strawberry Bank. She and Dorothy became very tight in their later years, right? United, I think, by this concern about what was happening to the little people in Portsmouth, what was happening to the middle and lower middle classes. Was Portsmouth being – Portsmouth is essentially pricing certain classes out. So I think she would be even more concerned about that today than she was in her 80s and 90s.
Leslie Pasternak plays Miss Dorothy Vaughan in Saving Portsmouth, The Preservation Crusades of Miss Dorothy Vaughan. It is a co-production between the Strawberry Bank Museum and Kent Stevens Stage Force. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
And Kent Stevens, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Kent Stevens wrote and directed the play, which has three remaining performances at the Tyco Visitor Center at Strawberry Bank this weekend. And as anyone knows who's been in those conversations about Port Walk, etc., there is plenty of drama in discussing development. There are more details on the play and showtime at wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to find out what happens when art, fashion, and technology collide. A dress that truly lights up a room when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Biologists call it signaling, traits and behaviors that evolved because recipients respond to them in ways that benefit the signaler. Among humans, the signals may not be quite as overt as the peacock fanning its tail or fireflies courting and sparking on a summer night. It is that luminescent dance that inspired the creative team called Synesthesia Muse to collaborate on a piece of wearable technology that first strutted across MIT's DeScience show and has now been on catwalks on both coasts. Harry Heumann, artist and chair of SNHU's Communications, Media, and Arts Technology Department, artist and dressmaker Deborah Caldwell, and the developer and inventor Angela Chang will be showing off the luminescent firefly dress at TEDx Amiskegmilyard this Saturday. We spoke with them earlier this week about the project, and I asked Angela Chang about the name. Why firefly?
Because fireflies have a unique way of communicating their state and communicating their identity and communicating with each other that humans attempt to perform when they're in social situations, in particular in a place where they're wearing fancy clothes, like in a nightclub, perform. Communication science applied to fashion can help people express themselves better and can help themselves identify with different cultures and social groups. Because, you know, you put on clothing, that's one thing, but if the clothing is active, if you could use it as a communication channel, well, then that's a whole nother level of being able to express who you are.
Okay, all right. You've just said so many fantastic things.
This also fit right in with my interest in LED lighting and interactivity, and so there was a good match there. And then with Deborah's help, we were able to bring this together into a garment that was beautifully sewn and crafted. And I think I'll let Deborah talk about her reaction.
Yeah, Deborah, I'd love to know. Describe to me, what does the luminous firefly dress look like?
Well, it looks almost like a lush garden.
So I'm seeing leaves.
I mean, there's
a lot some people have said it looks like a little bit like lettuce, and I don't take that as an insult at all. Lettuce is
ruffles.
Good for you.
It's green. It's a beautiful sort of a color of green that I associated with Italian fashion.
Yeah, I was inspired by Alexander McQueen and a number of Japanese designers. The Japanese designers incredibly forward-thinking in their use of materials, and I love the idea of the exoskeleton concept of, I don't want to say armor because that means kind of like war and battle, but kind of a shell that is beautiful in form and very expressive.
It also responds to sound, I understand. Like it responds.
I'm
going to
let Angela take that.
Okay, Angela.
So the firefly is an interesting creature because it has three modes of communication using its light. The first communication mode is to convey its identity. So if everyone in a space, all the other fireflies are echoing a particular pattern, and you're a part of that species, the firefly will echo the pattern of the species. And then the second mode is for the firefly to independently express its own identity for mating. And then the third mode is to express anger or stay away. So the mode where the music drives the dress, where the lights respond to ambient music, is conveying the social identity, like I'm hip, I'm part of the scene. That mirrors what the firefly does when it's part of the scene of its species in the fields of green at night.
Well, think Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the scene where they're communicating with the aliens through color and light and sound. Exactly.
That thing.
Exactly. These are things that are, I think, pretty universal throughout the cosmos. You know, light is universal.
Well, Harry, and you know, all of you, it's so interesting because we are moving towards wearable technology, or so we're told. You know, Google Glass may not have made quite as much of a difference as they thought they were going to, but I think it will happen. The iWatch. We have jackets that can charge phones and high-tech wicking in fabrics and glow-in-the-dark vests for runners. These are all about function in many, many ways. This is function or form?
It's both. It's creating something unique that you want to wear with something that could even eventually be something that you need to wear, you know, for health type of things.
Right, a heart monitor on your clothing or whatever.
But it is something that is fashionable that you want to wear.
But could this ever be something that would be mass marketed as a ready-to-wear dress? Or is someone only going to wear it to a nightclub or to Burning Man or something?
Well, I see it as something that performers are using already a lot. Who could have imagined the iPhone? I mean, these are all recent devices and technologies, and look how universal they are now and taken for granted.
Well, you know what I'd love to know from Deborah, actually, is, you know, you've been working with fabrics for so long, many different kinds of fabrics. I'm wondering what, working with technology, you were sort of working lights into this. How does that change as a factor of how you approach a garment, how you touch a garment, how you design it?
It was coming up with the basic silhouette first, and then figuring out how to integrate the lights into that and have them not just be lights but diffusion of the light to create shadows and even texture, look like the fabric is even more textured than what it is. Mm-hmm. So all those things were taken into consideration. And there was a lot of trial and error that, you know, we went through as far as the, you know, what was going to be the best way to create all of this and make it work. When we came up with the ruffled design that laid over the lights, it just kind of popped. And it was like, this is exactly what we were looking for.
It was a good marriage with the with the lights. But just to say something about the lights is that, without giving away our secret sauce, these are not Home Depot lights. There was quite a bit of research that went into everything at all ends, even though the technology itself that we used in the dress is not, you know, gigantically sophisticated, the way it had to come together to make an aesthetically appealing form was no a small trick.
So where to next? Are you guys going to continue to work together, this synesthesia muse team?
I hope so. I mean, we're talking. We're trying to catch our breaths because things have been, you know, nonstop. And we're doing some walking of these beautiful dresses at TEDx Amiskig Milliard coming up this week. We have all kinds of tasks on the books here for both Deborah and Angela, whether they know it or not.
Uh-oh, Angela.
Well, Harry Heumann, Deborah Caldwell, Angela Chang, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Virginia.
Thank you, Virginia.
Harry Heumann there, artist, professor, and chair of SNU's Communications, Media, Arts, and Technology Department. Deborah Caldwell, dressmaker and owner of Isabel and Me Studio, that's at the Wombeck Mill in Manchester. And the developer and inventor, Angela Chang. They are the team behind the luminescent firefly dress. We posted a few short films showing the dress off. It will also be on view at TEDx Amaskeg Milliard this Saturday. I'll be hosting this sold-out event, but you can watch it online. Details on both at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. Just imagine your ideas lighting up and then spreading to others on contact and causing them to light up. Well, that's how we think of word of mouth. Just no lights. Not yet, anyway. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth Sunday at noon right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.